Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. This is the Best Ever You Show, and I'm your host, Elizabeth Hamilton Guarino. And this is one of those moments where you pray you have a co-host and a guest. I'm here by myself waiting for Director Bobby Roth to call in. So hopefully we'll have him as a guest shortly. I did just text him the phone number to call in. If you're listening, you can call right in from your phone. So hopefully we'll get that. In the meantime, we hope you will visit us online at besteveryou.com. And then also, we started a new community online where you can, you know, join our network. And that address is besteverycommunity.com. So I'm not sure if we're going to hang up and delete the show or if Bobby Roth will be joining us. So I should play like elevator music while we're waiting. That's too funny. Here he is. Okay, hang on just a minute.
Hello.
<you are. laughs> That was funny. I don't have a co-host today, so I started the show, and we were waiting for you. You're live on air.
Hi, Bobby.
Hi, Bobby. Thank you
so
much
for
joining us.
You're waiting for someone else. I'm disappointing you.
No. We were waiting for you. So thank you for joining us. We have Bobby Roth with us live for the next hour. And we were talking a little bit before. I sent you a big email about all the things I wanted to talk to you about. But there's so much written about you online. I'm just going to start off. What's most important to you out of everything you've ever done?
I don't know that I got a big email about what we're doing. So
didn't?
I feel a little unprepared. Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's nothing new. Well, we've talked before anyway. So I basically thought we would go through some of the movies, some of the TV shows that you've done, but you know, just kind of basically have a chat about who you are, so people get to know you a little bit better. But you know, I did in
sure.
trying to prepare to talk to you for an hour. You know, of course, I went snooping around on the internet trying to find something to, you know, but volumes of information come up about you. And you've been doing this. You were a philosophy major in college, but then you jumped into movies and so forth and film. Was that what you intended on doing?
I was a lost boy in college, and philosophy was just one of the many stops along the road. I went to college on a golf scholarship. I thought I would go into my dad's business. He was a small carpet manufacturer. But it was a very exciting time, 1969. And I ended up transferring to Berkeley, where I thought I would become a writer. I was pretty much radicalized by the anti-war movement and sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and gave up golf and business and started, you know, writing first poetry and then trying to write a novel and then realizing I wasn't very good at any of that. I transferred to film school. I went to USC for a year, and then I went to graduate school at UCLA. And along the way, met a lot of really kind of great, crazy people who had a powerful effect and turned me into a very left-wing guy at first and then hopefully an artist along the way.
Yeah. Now, of all the things that you've done, is Berkeley what you're most proud of?
You know, the films are like children. It's like, you know, if you had to pick which kid you're most proud of, you'd have a tough time because you love them all. I don't think Berkeley is the best film. My son feels Manhood is my best movie, and I tend to trust my son a lot. I made a film 25 years ago called Heartbreakers, which was probably the most successful, at least critically. You know, I go back and forth. For those of you who don't know me, I go back and forth between mainstream television and independent film, and I definitely prefer movies, and I prefer things that I write, but I think I've been pretty lucky, and I've had a good life doing things that I like to do.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that, too. In the list of things I was going to ask you, has your life been, I ask you this intentionally, has your life been easy, or has your life been difficult?
Well, relative to the great majority of people in the world, it's been very easy. But, you know, everybody's got to judge themselves by their own experiences. So I think often I've made my life more difficult than it needed to be.
Don't we all?
I tend to be someone who overanalyzes and overcontemplates. And I also, I think I've been somebody who has always tried to go for the exotic, and I've gotten into trouble by going places where I, you know, I wasn't really safe. And I mean that both, you know, physically and psychologically. So, but I'm sure, like most of your listeners, I wouldn't trade much. You know, it's been, you know. And I hope there's more to come.
Oh yeah, yeah, you know there is. Now, when you're you and you're doing all of these wonderfully, you know, neat things to, you know, just the average person who's not in Hollywood and not in that industry, you know. You know, you're cool. You know, you're amazing. And everybody, you know, everybody wants to be a director or in movies or in TV, you know, all that stuff.
I'm always so surprised that people say they want to be directors because almost no one knows what the job entails.
Well, that's what I wanted to talk to you about. What does a director do exactly? You know, is it just show up and say, you know, cut and roll them, you know, all that stuff? Or is there more to it than that?
No, well, I mean, I've taken to teaching in the last 10 years, and I teach at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, and I've also been traveling doing these seminars. I'm going to do the first one in Los Angeles, but I was in Australia in November, and I'm very much a believer that in order to do a good job as a director, it really takes take place long before that in prep. And so... you know, I have my course, which I've been teaching, starts when they hand you a script, and I try to take people through the process, my process, all the way to we turn in the director's cut. And that necessarily entails a lot of, you know, location scouting, casting, reading and rereading the script and interpreting the script and meeting with the heads of all your departments, and that can be your production designer and your art director for your sets, your... costumes, you spend a lot of time with your director of photography trying to figure out, you know, how to best photograph it, because everything we see in a film is seen through a lens. And then also, you know, working backwards kind of from the editing room, because everything is in pieces, even though hopefully it doesn't feel that way when you watch the final product.
Right.
It's really an amalgamation of about 100 jobs, and you're the lion tamer. You're the maestro, trying to you know organize everybody, and you have to have a vision of what the end product is, and at the same time you have to be open for everybody else's vision and allow yourself to be surprised. You can't just have a very definitive way that you want an actor to play a scene, and then take the actor's own creativity out of it. You have to say. To the actor, that part works. Let's try it this way. What if we did this? It's a lot of answering of questions, and you have to enjoy that if you want to do this job.
Yeah, and is it actually fun, or is it an incredible amount of work, or some combination of both?
Well, the work isn't hard. I mean, the work is hard in a sense that there's a lot of it, but it can be very satisfying. It really is very, it's like most jobs, it's specific to the show you're working on. I just did The Mentalist, which is a really well-organized, really, really well-run show, and I had nothing but fun. Every actor was prepared, they were open, you knew you were part of a creative process, everybody wanted it to be good, everybody did their homework, which is really important. The DP I worked with, this guy Frank Pearl, was, you know, always working one step, so we'd be on a scene, he'd say, so where do we want to put the, you know, how are we going to stage the next scene? And it was just a very good experience. And
then
it is fun. But when you say, is it hard? It's hard and it's fun, because it's, you know, our days are long. You know, you leave the house at 6 in the morning, you come home at 9, and then you do your homework, you know, and then you go back to work the next morning. But it's very satisfying to do something and have it, you know, feel fresh. And, you know, I was thrilled that I think 16 million people saw the episode. That's a lot of people.
It's a lot of people. That's a great show. Yeah, it is. So when you do it, what'd you say?
I said I hope to go back next season.
Yeah. When you do a show like that, the actors are famous and out there, the director's famous and out there. Is there somebody behind the scenes who's really, really important that doesn't, you know, get promoted as much as, you know, say, you know, the main actor in the production?
Oh, well, by far the most important person is what they call the showrunner, the executive producer, writer person who oversees all of the shows. I mean, I think a lot of your audience may not know that that there's a lot of different directors working on a show, because while I'm doing episode 17, somebody is preparing episode 18 and someone is editing episode 16.
Oh.
And the ongoing force are the writing producers, the executive producer. And on that show, there's a great guy named Bruno Heller, who is the there's a lot of executive producers. There's also a guy named Chris Long, who mostly focuses on the directing part of it. But but these guys are probably less known to the public, but they're certainly, you know, the biggest forces. And you know, not that Simon's not a force, because he's a real force, but but on a good show like that show, everybody is kind of in tune with everybody. You know, Simon has questions and needs, and they address them, and then, you know, they'll have, you know, a mandate for all of us. You know, and the difference in when I come from doing a movie, like I did a movie in the summer for Lifetime, in the movie you kind of are starting more from scratch. You put your team together, you cast every role, you work with the writer to get the script in shape. Everything, you know, all the sets start with you. On a TV show, I come into The Mentalist, it's an interesting situation because you're both a guest and the leader. You're the leader for that.
Oh, yeah.
Eight days of shooting. So people want to know your vision, but your vision has to be, you know, I don't want to say subordinate to the vision of the show, but you have to find what the rhythm of the show is.
Right.
In preparation, usually what I do is I watch, you know, as many as, well, in the case of Lost, I watched all 55 episodes before I did number 56.
Really?
And, yeah. I didn't even do that show. In the case of The Mentalist, I think I watched at least 10 to try to see what the rhythm is, how they, you know, you're not going to do it exactly like they do it, but you want to know that, like, if you're doing Prison Break, and that was my main show, I did 14 of those, you have to know that they like extreme close-ups. If you don't shoot extreme close-ups, you're not going to be in the rhythm of that show. You're not going to be giving, you're not going to be giving those producers what they need their final cut.
I didn't know that. I thought, I don't know, maybe I'm thinking like Happy Days or something, and maybe they didn't do it back then either, but I guess my perception of was, you know, here's the director, here are the people that write it, you know, and it was just a crew, and that crew was the crew always. Huh.
The crew
so
is
it's not
the crew
that way.
Always. The visitor is the only new people are the director and the guest cast. And so the only real things I bring to it is a certain my sensibility and who the guest supporting cast. I think I cast maybe 6 or 8 people on The Mentalist, for instance. And some shows like Lost, there's very few guest cast because you're on an island.
That's the one I begged you to let me get eaten by a dinosaur or something funny. Like, I want to be on that.
you don't have quite as much. You're trying to, you're dealing with much different issues.
Yeah.
You know, every show has a personality. Lost had a very different personality than The Mentalist. Criminal Minds is very different. Without a Trace had a very particular, you know, I came into that, you know, late in their run. So it was a whole different sensibility that was going on. You have to kind of catch the rhythm of the show. And some of them, you know, I did a show called Numbers a few years ago, and I just didn't get it. I never caught their rhythm. They didn't really blend or appreciate what I was bringing to it. And it wasn't a terribly happy experience. And it's it's really nobody's fault, you know.
Yeah.
It was much more just, you know, when I caught on to Prison Break, what my personal taste was blended very, very well with the taste of the show.
Now, when you do a show like that, are you on set in Los Angeles? Are you somewhere on location in another country, or where do those get shot, or are they all over the place?
The show is in one place, but different shows are in different places. The Mentalist is shot, I would say their pattern, they call it a pattern, what they try to do every week. That doesn't mean every script is different, because if in this case they're flying, you know, that's a show that's set in Sacramento, but we shoot at Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a few establishing shots, you know, that they call stock shots, that exist that were shot by their team of Sacramento to
route
you there. And then, but you find your four of the days are usually spent at Warner Brothers, because the CBI offices are built there. In many cases, other sets are built on stage. And then you go out and try to find, the director will now find, you know, depending on the script. I had a medical show, so we found a hospital, one I had shot in before. We built 2 days on stage of hospital, and we shot at a real hospital for 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
But it was all done in the Los Angeles area.
Mm-hmm.
Prison Break was unusual because the first year was in Chicago, and it was shot in that surrounding area, and we went out to Joliet Prison to shoot exteriors, and then we shot some of the cells on stage. And then the second year, when they break out of prison, the second and third year, we were in Dallas, and they were on the run, and we were supposedly all over the country, but in reality, we were in Dallas. And the third year, they were in Panama, but we still shot in Dallas, and we built a Panamanian prison. And then the fourth year, they ended up in Los Angeles, because that's where Wentworth knew I wanted to spend the fourth year. Didn't want to go away anymore, and he was strong enough at that point to influence them. And so that's the only show I can think of that actually was based in three different cities in 4 years. But usually, you know, like if you go to do, like I did the show V last year, and it shot up in Vancouver.
Yeah, I wondered why you were in Vancouver, what you were doing, and was it for that show, or do you go there a lot for other things too?
I went there also. I did two shows in Vancouver last year. I also did a show called Life Unexpected for the CW.
Yes.
Yep. That was based in Vancouver also.
Okay.
And then I did a movie in Toronto. That's when I was close to Maine.
Yep. I love Canada. It's beautiful. I took a trip all the way, well, not all the way across, but halfway across, and then came down through the States, and it's beautiful up there. But when you're traveling around like that, is your career your life, or is your life your career? Or is it some combination?
Well, it's I have an 8-year-old daughter, and I'm looking more and more to spend my time in Los Angeles. You go where the work is, so you know, sometimes you wake up surprised that you're living in a hotel room in Vancouver when you've worked very hard to have a house and, you know, a neighborhood in Los Angeles where your daughter goes to school and your friends are. But it's just, you know, I didn't know that when I was in school. And in fact, one of the things that when you and I were talking about this call, I was going to mention was just how much the business has changed since when I got into it. When I came out of film school, I really thought I would spend the great majority of my time in Los Angeles, except maybe going away to do shoots. But I didn't think I'd ever be at television. Television was a very different animal. It was almost exclusively shot on stages, and it was pretty, for my way of thinking, kind of dull. And it just, the business changed, you know. I think financial issues became much more dominant, you know. I initially thought, you know, the people, you know, this is more of an art form which people made money on. Maybe, and to some extent it was, but it's very much now all about money.
Money.
And
yeah.
What people like me do is try to eke out any little piece of artistic expression or joy from a business. That's what we're doing.
Yeah. Now, but you can just see even in, you know, since I was a kid, you know, I was born in 1969, and when I was a kid, the TVs used to shut off at midnight, and then a big, I can't remember it exactly, but a big circle would come on, and it would be kind of like a tone until maybe like 6 or 8 in the morning, and there weren't, you know, the TVs had knobs. And
my daughter was asking me about this recently because...
Yeah.
She feels that she's bereft if the set doesn't have TiVo. If she can't pause a show,
kids,
it feels like a hardship.
Uh-huh. Tough life, huh? Yeah, used to have to get up and actually change the channel with a knob. Oh, my gosh. Anyway.
One of the things I was saying to her was also that we only had one TV in our house when I was growing up.
We did too.
And we watched as a family. And not only
did
it shut off at a certain time, but almost all the viewing was created not for niche audiences, but there was no nip tuck for the perverse. There was,
Dallas.
You watched Ed Sullivan. Well, you're later than me. You watched, My Little Margie or Miss Brooks, and it was okay for the kids to see it, and it was okay for the parents, and somehow it was good. I mean,
it was simple.
They made good shows that were for everybody. They don't seem...
Yeah. I loved Little House on the Prairie, Gilligan's Island, Dallas. You know, our family used to gather around for Dallas when it was on, and that was a big deal.
I believe you, but see, this is why I didn't want to do TV, because I didn't like those shows. And then I got a divorce and had to support my son, and suddenly I was doing 90210 and Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman, and the equivalent of what I considered selling out, and not having nearly as much fun doing it and driving everybody else crazy as well.
Yeah. Now, you have, I don't know how many movies you have done, but you seem to love independent films. And a couple of them have been at Sundance. Now, to me, that's a big deal.
I've actually had five movies at Sundance.
At Sundance. Now, to me, that's like, wow, that's really neat. Is that the same to you? Is that a big honor to have something at Sundance when you're already in the business and so forth?
You know, the whole notion of honor, it's funny because,
I
means
less
to you in retrospect. You know, you want to get in because it's how you hope to get your film distributed, which in turn will get people to see it, which is kind of why you made it, and also because you hope that it'll kind of up your status so that you'll get the ability to make another movie. It's pretty much been that since I was at UCLA in 1975-76, and I did a feature film for my master's thesis, which was about a black couple that comes from the South to Los Angeles, and it was pretty much a slice of life about their relationship. And and that movie somehow managed to travel all over the world, to Cannes, to Edinburgh, to Perth, Australia, and I got to go with it, and it opened up this whole world for me. But what it mostly did was it was something to show with a new script that I wrote to get money to do my second film. So for at least the first 10 years of my life, maybe the first 15, my life in film, it was just showing what I'd done last to get the next picture. And, you turn around and suddenly you've done, 25 movies for TV and 60-something television shows and 13 features.
That's why it was hard for me to rattle them all off.
It's been a lot of work.
It's a lot.
But they're always you don't do them simultaneously. So when you're on one, it's the most important thing you're doing. And later you kind of think, that really wasn't very good, was very good.
Yeah, I've noticed that in knowing you a little bit more personally, that you work and then you stop for a little bit, and then you work again and then you stop for a little bit. Is that what you mean? Because sometimes it's Yeah, I tend not to bug you when
mostly,
I know you're...
It's mostly the vagaries of employment. There are times when I don't stop. I don't stop necessarily because I feel like, oh, I think I'll stop.
No. Yeah,
it's,
no.
It's mostly just, you know, it's like you finish this, now what's next? And you get on the
exactly.
phone and you start bugging your agents or, you know, I try to use, I mean, when I'm not employed, most of what I'm doing is writing, trying to come up with new scripts to do my own thing.
Mm-hmm. There's not a lot written about you about your private life. You're pretty quiet. There's, you know, it's not like there's
yeah,
a camera
a
in your
thing,
face following you around and stuff. Yeah, that's a good thing, right? do you? Yes, that's a good thing. Do you like to talk about your children?
Yeah,
or
no,
do you keep
them
private?
I have a great life. My both my kids, and you know, I live with my daughter and her mom, and who I love, who's, you know, I mean, it's not a big secret. Mm-hmm. It's Pam Springsteen. I've been with her for on and off for 18 years, and she's great. She's a photographer. Mm-hmm. My daughter is in second grade. I have a son, Nick, and he's getting his PhD at Cornell. He's actually mm-hmm. in the air right now, flying to Los Angeles for his break. Mm-hmm. More and more, as you know, because you're a family person, that's what becomes most important to everybody as they get, wiser.
Mommy of four, yeah, it's about them. Do you see a lot of yourself in the kids?
That's a good question. Sometimes, but most of it just makes me laugh. It's usually the more eccentric and the difficult stuff that you see, you know. I think my son, for the most part, is the best of me. He has, you know, they're very, you know, the kids are very much their own people, and they come out with a certain... And then, you know, because I was alone all those years with Nick, being a single mm-hmm. father, I think he probably has more characteristics. He would probably not want to admit this, but he's probably more like me than either of us ever expected. But it was less about what I said and more just, you know, mm-hmm. you know, I was kind of a hippie and had long hair. He's kind of a hippie and has long hair. He's more intellectual, but he's what I wanted to be in some ways. You know, mm-hmm. he loves basketball. I love basketball. I couldn't get him to play golf.
Well, I was going to ask you, yeah, you love to play golf. Is he a golfer?
I'm not a golfer? Yeah. No, I went back to, you know, golf is something I played because my dad played golf. And and when I went off to Berkeley, I kind of looked over it for 15 years because the conservatism of the sport and the world around the sport didn't mesh with the radicalism. And I did a movie in, I guess it was 87, called Baja, Oklahoma, mm-hmm. which was quite a good film for HBO. It mm-hmm. was Julia Roberts' first movie, and it had a really interesting eclectic, you know, Leslie Ann Warren, Peter Coyote, Susie Kurtz, Willie Nelson. It was a really interesting movie.
Oh, wow, that's a great...
And it was a novel. It was a novel by a guy, a wonderful writer named Dan Jenkins, a Texas writer. And when Dan and I were doing the movie, he heard that I had played golf when I was younger, and he had this book called Dead Solid Perfect, which I had read, which is still, to this day, I think the funniest book ever written about golf, in a world of funny books about golf. And Dan and I took the book to HBO and made a deal to make it as an HBO film with Randy Quaid playing the lead role, who that would be a whole hour with somebody else to talk about where Randy's gone.
Yeah.
But which I'm not prepared to do. I had a great time making the movie, and it got me back into the game. And so for the last 20, 25 years, I've been playing again. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah, you took a trip to – where did you go?
I went to Scotland last June to play golf and drink scotch and had a great time.
At the same time or –
No, not at the same time. Usually we would play golf in the daytime and drink scotch at night. I went with my best friend. And we had a lot of fun.
Yeah, I might be the world's worst golfer. I mean, seriously.
There's a lot of people laying claim to that title, but
I don't know. I think I win it. I really do. I got the crown for that one. I mean, I really can't golf. I think it went somewhere, and the ball's just sitting right there.
I'll tell you my Willie Nelson golf story is that when I was doing Baja, I became friends with Willie, and I knew that he played golf almost every day, and he loved the game. And he said to me, you know, at one point, why don't you come? I'm going to be in Las Vegas. Why don't you come to Vegas and play golf? And I was kind of excited. You know, who doesn't look up to Willie Nelson? You know.
Yeah.
And so I practiced for, you know, the previous week so that my game would be sharp. And I drove to Las Vegas from L.A., and I was very excited. And we got there, and we go up to the first tee, and Willie and his buddies are smoking Willie weed, which is a very strong blend of a substance that I'm sure you're familiar with. And so we tee off, and I can't believe how bad they are. For people who love the game, they were all hitting it sideways. And I don't even think it was because they were stoned, but that probably had something to do with it. And I was, like, really seriously trying to play well.
Trying to be great.
Smoking pot. And about after eight holes, they'd had enough, and they just said, let's go in. And I was, like, really seriously into my game, and I think I was, like, one under par, and that was it. And as we were walking away, I realized, you know, that not everybody regards the game the same way I do.
Yeah. What do you do right there when that happens? Do you just go with them, or did you finish your game?
Yeah,
or?
Of course. No, I came to be with Willie Nelson. I didn't give a play, you know, golf
really.
You know, I mean, golf is always kind of an excuse to be with people. I mean, it was the reason I played golf to begin with was to be with my dad, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I wish I could golf better, but I do have a set of pink golf clubs that I purchased last year that I thought might improve my game. I'm going to try them out this year. I doubt it'll help. Yeah, anyway, they're pink. All right. You mentioned you traveled all around. Is there anywhere you haven't been that you still want to visit?
Oh, sure. There's a lot of places. I mean, the great thing about, at least years ago, the independent filmmaker life was that I think I went to over 100 film festivals around the world, and I got, you know, there was a reason to go places, and usually you could get them to pay for your plane and you know, always put you up and treat you. But there are a lot of, I love to travel. One of the things my son still indulges me in, and what he's given me for my last birthday was he said he would take another trip with me this year. So in a month or two, I'm going to Spain for the first time. I've never been to Spain. I'm looking forward to that. But I mean, you know, there's almost nowhere I don't want to go. I mean, it's hard to prioritize, you know.
Mm-hmm.
My son and I have gone to Cuba together. We've gone to Russia. We've gone to Romania, where my family's from.
Mm-hmm.
All over France, all over Italy. You know, I went to Africa when I was quite young to work on a movie, but I haven't really, you know, this. You know, I think the place I'd like to go most, but my son wasn't that interested, is Israel. I've never been to Israel, and I think, you know.
Yeah.
Most Jews want to at least experience, you know, the history of that country.
Yeah. Yeah, that's neat, because a lot of us have never been able to leave the United States. Or visit, have you visited all of the states?
I'm trying to think. I'm sure there's a couple of states I haven't been to, but I would say I've been to almost everywhere. I've worked in, you know, it's another good thing about the business. I've worked almost everywhere, too, which is, you know, I think you experience things differently if you're working.
What you do for a living.
I wouldn't have chosen to spend, you know, 4.5 months in a year in Dallas by my choice, but it was, it turned out to be kind of a good experience, and I had a feeling and understanding for Texas that I don't think I would have, you know, without the job, I don't think I would have done that, but I was glad for it, you know.
Yeah, that's, you know, I was raised in Iowa, and so when I, you know, hit the age of 21, I thought I made the biggest move of my life up to Minneapolis, and then had this great guy. Seriously, so that when you're telling me about all these different countries, you know, consider the person you're talking to. But, you know, my big highlight, I remember in my 20s, was getting to go to New York City, because all of my life I had dreamed of going there, seeing it on TV and seeing all of these things. And I got to New York City and I was just loved it. You know, just any chance I get, I love to go to New York City. It's just the neatest thing to me. Isn't that funny?
No, but I think everybody, I mean,
yeah.
You know, if you're open at all, it's the travel is just, you know,
amazing.
Just to see different cultures. And, I mean, one of the things that I lament sometimes is how homogenized the world is. That, you know, we're walking down the street in Rome and there's a banana republic. It's
yeah.
It's not the same as when I was a kid,
no.
But on the other hand, you're still in Rome, and
yeah.
you're still getting to, you know, and experience it with people you love. Like, I like to travel with Nick because he really loves art. He drags me all, you know, if we go to a museum, we have to see every piece of art in that museum.
Yeah. I'm like that too. I love art.
Too.
Yeah. What is she? Yeah, she's,
yes.
Oh my gosh, your kids are so beautiful. Yeah, they're just cute. And your son has your curly hair. How do you
my
take care of that hair? Let's talk about that. Let's keep traveling and go to the hair.
have you ever
hair
that's
your hair out?
For radio.
Your hair, it's all curly.
I have a question for you.
Oh, yeah.
Who's listening to us right now? No, I'm just curious
who
your audience is.
It's, you know, it's whoever tunes in, but, you know, it just depends on the guest and who listens. But once we stop taping, because, you know, it's a live show, it's always on our radio show. And so anybody can listen to it at any time. So a lot of the people who are at work right now listen later. And they just go to our show and download it.
No, I put it up on my Facebook site, and I got a lot of hits this morning. Are you really going to do that?
Yeah, but
so
you
know
the beauty of it too is, the beauty of this format too is we have control of it. Like if we get done with the interview, and like you say, gosh, I hated that. We can delete it. We can tape another time. So yeah, it's kind of cool like that. But I have more questions for you if you don't mind. We have
sure.
I don't know how many more minutes we have. Just as a normal person who's not in Hollywood, it would appear like you know everybody. Is there anyone that you have, I'm going on the, is there anybody who you haven't met or haven't traveled kind of theme here? Is there anybody who you haven't met that you would love to meet yet?
Oh, sure. Of course. I mean, I've been lucky because I have met a lot of great people over the years. But I think I'm a reader, and I think for me, authors are some of the more fascinating people who I've never met. Probably number one would be Philip Roth. I'm a big fan of his writing. Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Let's see. I mean, Walter Mosley, in a more popular vein, but a wonderful, serious writer. I mean,
the more authors.
You know, these are people that don't. Yeah, those would be all my first choices. I mean, I'm lucky because I've been good friends with. He's a big star, Bruce Springsteen, for 30 years.
Yeah.
So through Bruce, I've met a lot of, you know, rock and roll personages who I would have liked to have met. There aren't, you know, I mean, you know, to meet someone is not as exciting as actually get to work with someone. You know, to just say hello to Bob Dylan would be kind of a thrill, but it wouldn't be nearly as interesting as actually, you know, having something to do work-wise with someone like that so that you could really, you know, really see them in their element. Just to shake hands with somebody isn't so exciting.
Yeah, I always wonder what that is, what that phenomenon is, because people, you know, you'll say, well, you know, who's somebody, I was hoping your answer would be as deep as it is, because, you know, a lot of people, you know, pine away their existence to, you know, like shake hands one time with like Tom Hanks or something. And it, to me, it would be like, yeah, that's great and everything, but I'd rather sit down and actually get to know the person or do something with them, or, you know, like you're saying, like play around a basketball or go golfing or do something.
And it's
just to shake somebody's hand.
The reason I say work is I've actually had many dinners with Tom Hanks, but not because of me, because of Bruce. They're friends, and I must have had a minimum of 10 dinners. But I don't really feel, I feel like I've experienced him, but I don't really feel like we had one evening where I think we talked together, and that was a good experience for me because we were talking about being young and getting started. But most of the time, if you meet celebrities, especially at parties or at events, you're not really scratching the surface. I used to do a lot more of that because it was very helpful in my career. When I was married to my son's mother, she was an executive at Sony Pictures, and we would go out 3 to 5 nights a week to events. And it really helps your career, but it is exhausting, and it's not very satisfying. I would rather go to bed early, get up really early and write, and the people that I commune with, to have real time with 2 or 3 hours. I just had lunch the other day with a director named Peter Medic, who, if you don't know, he's a wonderful director and has really lived a very rich and full life. And I think we had like a 3-hour lunch. For me, the biggest thing that I'm afraid of in life is missing it, is going through things superficially, not really being present either for my kids or for my work. So when you have an experience with, I have a mentor named Robert Young. He's a director. Bob is 86 years old.
That's my dad. That's one of my dad's favorite people. Sorry to interrupt you.
Do you know which one? It's the same Bob Young?
Uh-huh.
Sure?
Yep.
Okay, well, he's pretty much one of the most amazing people I've ever met. And he's not a big celebrity, but he's lived this incredibly rich life. He's had 5 kids. He's made movies for, 60, 70 years. And he's just got this great humility and wisdom that whenever I spend an hour with this guy, I wouldn't trade it. There is no celebrity I would trade it for. In a book that I've been trying to write for many years, it's a lot of that is kind of portraits of people. Some are who are famous, some are who you've never heard of, but they're all what I consider remarkable people. It's interesting to me how there are people like Bruce who became big stars, who are, to me, brilliant talents, but then there are other people like Bob, who I think in his own way is just as brilliant and just as much a genius, but really doesn't connect with that mainstream of society. I'm rambling, I'm sorry.
No, you're fine. It's the same kind of thing, with doing a show like this, where, everybody says, well, you've got to have, a Kardashian on or something to even, hit a target market and have all these people listen and all this stuff. And I'm like, well, but that's not what I want to do. I want to find interesting people.
They may not be the most interesting person to listen to, not that I know these people.
Yeah, I don't know them at all. But I just try to find, people that I can reach that are interesting to come on to the show. I don't know if I could ever even reach them, but I have another question for you. I've known you for a little while now. You are in every picture I've ever seen of you. You're always pretty much smiling, and if you're not smiling, actually smiling, you smile through your eyes, and you seem to be always very, very nice to everyone. Is there anything that ever makes you really mad?
But you're interesting. I'm getting to an age where I like to try to dispense wisdom, or at least what I believe is wisdom. And I lost a very good friend in November, who had been also a mentor to me, named Irv Kirshner, who was a wonderful director who had lived a very full life, but had done some wonderful smaller movies. But also, you guys would know him because he directed The Empire Strikes Back and one of the big Bond movies, Never Say Never, and RoboCop 2. But just an amazing soul and incredibly generous to me. And there was a memorial for him that his sons put on at the Directors Guild. The memorial was in the beginning of January. You found out all these wonderful things about his life. I knew him pretty well, and I knew him for 30 years, but I didn't know him so much as a professor, which he was also. He taught at the University of Maryland, and this woman got a And she quoted, and I'm going to mess this up because I don't know who she was quoting him. Well, I'm blocking him, but the quote is what's important. She said, there are three things that you have to know in life. The first is to be kind. The second is to be kind.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure you know what the third one is.
The third one.
And so it's to be kind. And so that's if I learn nothing else, the film business really teaches you both the value and the pleasure of kindness. And it's an incredibly collaborative business. And for the great, great majority of people I've worked with, they are kind. Mm-hmm. They work hard. They're grateful. We all know we're lucky to be working in a business that's as enjoyable, you know, and mm-hmm. creative and exciting. And especially today, much more than when I first came up, and maybe it's that I'm mellowing, but I think it's also the way the business has changed. People are just very nice to each other. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like that's an industry.
I'm lucky. I'm making, you know, $200,000 a week. I was very surprised in the last season, or the second to last season of Lost. I did an episode, and it was the main character. You know how that show would focus on one of the leads, mm-hmm. and this was one of Evangeline Lilly's shows. And even though it was the 50th year, and even though she was getting paid a lot of money, she came on her own time during my prep period just to rehearse with me and to talk with me for hours because she mm-hmm. wanted it to be good and she wanted to be prepared. And what I was struck by was how much she appreciated how lucky she was. I mean, first of all, mm-hmm. she's a gorgeous woman and a very bright woman, but also she had never done any real acting work before she was cast in the show. Mm-hmm. And suddenly she was making, you know, lots and lots of money and being a big star. But she realized her good fortune and returned it by, she was an advocate for the crew. She was good to everybody. She showed up even, you know, there's a lot of stress mm-hmm. on people like this. She always was, you know, I mean, I never saw anything but friendly. And I worked on a number of those episodes with her. And everybody was like that on that show.
What happens when somebody is just a complete jerk?
Everybody suffers. One person can make your life really tough. Mm-hmm. Many, many years ago, I worked on a show, and the lead actor was just, you know, crazy.
Mm-hmm.
There's no other way to describe her behavior. Yeah. But today you see less and less of it. That's one of the biggest changes. Mm-hmm. There's just too many talented, nice people. They just don't put up with it anymore. Almost every place I go, the experiences. I mean, I've done a lot of different shows, you know, at least 10 different shows over the last few years, and I can't think of one where the people were nice, you know, mm-hmm. both the cast and the crew.
Yeah, I noticed that.
Occasionally there'll be one person. I had trouble with a person on a show about 2 years ago, and it was funny because she was an executive producer who made my life hell, and she was fired on my last day of shooting. Too late to help me, but at least it was kind of nice to know that she wasn't going to torture that crew anymore.
Of
course, she's going on to another show, and she's torturing them.
Of course. That's the way that goes. I notice that seems to be an industry where most people are pretty genuinely nice. Now, do the people who have been in the industry a long time help the new people? Is there a lot of mentoring going on and a lot of...
There's a lot of mentoring. Everybody, almost everybody you meet my age can tell you stories about people who, you know, have been good to them, who are good to them along the way. And there is a great tradition of giving it back, you know. I mean, I think... The initial, now I'm really enjoying teaching for my own sake, and I'm doing these seminars, but I think the initial impetus was just, you know, here's a bunch of people, you know, you can help them. They are going on this road that you've been on for all these years, and you can give them some direction, and it gives you pleasure to do it, you know.
What do you think of reality TV?
Oh, that's a sore point.
Oh, it is.
I mean,
okay,
as a fiction filmmaker and artist, I mean, you know, it greatly cut into my livelihood. You know, if you ask me what happened to movies for television, which was, you know, a way I made my living for many, many years, there are no more, you know. They've all gone, you know, because they were much more expensive to produce than, you know, who wants to sleep with my teenage daughter or whatever. There are good shows and people are hooked, you know, Dancing with the Stars, American Idol. I get it why they work. They're great, you know.
Yeah.
My family is like glued to American Idol. But they have, you know, just as a person working in the business, they've cut into my livelihood because there was drama made. You know?
Okay. We'll move off of that one. wrong question.
No, it's fine.
Yeah.
I'm teasing.
No. Not a big Snooki fan, huh? I'm kidding. I'm not either, but where do you draw inspiration?
For better or for worse, you know, my topics as a writer pretty much came from my own life.
Okay.
You know, Jack the Dog is about my divorce. Manhood is about my sister's life and death. Berkeley is about, you know, my involvement in the anti-war movement and growing up. So it comes from, you know, usually real life. I mean, in terms of inspiration as people, they're usually artists, and I'm lucky because they're often people, you know. I was very lucky that I met Costa Gavras, who's a great filmmaker, when I was 26. My friend Rob Nielsen has been a source of inspiration. I met him when I was 26. Like I said, Bob Young, Irv Kirshner. I mean, there are people I've been lucky enough who've mentored me, who've inspired me. I look at the way, when I met Costa Gavras, I thought, and for those of you who don't know him, he's a French-Greek phenomenal filmmaker who made a film that I saw when I was a kid called Sea. It was made in 19... It was the Academy Award winner for Best Foreign Film of 1969.
Okay.
But he was this incredibly handsome, incredibly generous, incredibly nice, and brilliantly talented guy. And I said, oh, I want to be like that. You know,
yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
That was better than being a rock star. You know, that was,
yeah.
you know, those.
Okay, so how much time do we have? We have like 9 minutes left to talk to you. Have I completely missed anything that you would want people to know about you?
To know about me? I don't know.
Yeah.
Anybody to know anything about
me?
I think the joke within my household is the most important thing any of us can do is change, you know, is that life is about, you know, you may not be perfect, but you can always get better. And I think that's the wisdom it's pretty simple, you know, it's like listen. You know, especially in my case, and historically, listen to women. And
you sure?
For a great, yeah, really. No,
it
was hard for me, and I lived many years either alone or with my son in a very male-dominated home, and now I live with only females, including the dog. And there's a lot to learn there. You know.
Yeah. Yeah, I live with, five boys and then all the animals.
I was going to say, you
have
a very big male-dominated home.
Yeah, I'm totally baseball, totally, oh my gosh, yeah, everything. I want to kind of go back to some of the movies that you've made with just a little bit of time left.
Sure.
Could you pick one of them and one that, you know, I know they're all like your children and you, but pick one if you would. And maybe talk about how you made that movie.
I'll expand a little broader than that. The late 90s, I had been away from independent filmmaking and doing a lot of movies for TV and finding it very tough to get my own things made. And my dad died. And he left me a little money, and my friend Rob, who has always been a maverick in making movies for virtually no money, directed my attention to a Danish film called The Celebration, which was the first Dogma film. Mm-hmm. And I went to see this movie, and 10 minutes into it, I said, Jesus, this looks terrible. And 20 minutes into it, tears were streaming down my face. I had been caught by the wave of the film. And I remembered that one could go, and with a good script and actors, you can do anything. And I decided to make the first of this little trilogy of films of mine on my own, breaking the most important rule I had learned over the 25 years in the business, which is don't put your own money in. And I put my own money in, and I made this film, Jack the Dog, about my divorce and my kind of coming of age as a single father. And it was the best experience I'd ever had. You know, I got my friends together. I got some known actors like Anthony LaPaglia and Peter Coyote and Thomas Gibson and people. And we just had a great time. And we made this film, which was very heartfelt. And Bruce gave me some music for it. And we went to Sundance with the movie. And it was such a good experience that everybody said, well, we should do another one. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, it had been my money. They were all saying, we should do another one.
Yeah, of course.
And I kind of made a lot of my money back, but not all of it. But, you know, being crazy, I did a sequel a couple years later called Manhood, and John Ritter, who ended up being, unfortunately, John's last movie, and Janine Garofalo came, and they helped me tell the story. I used all the same actors from the first movie, and my own son then performed in the second movie, with playing the son of John and Janine. And and I had this experience making this movie, Manhood, which was a phenomenal experience because my sister had a rather tragic life. And I got to tell her story and once again went back and premiered at Sundance. And those movies, you know, certainly were, you know, in many ways the best experiences because they were really made with love and nothing. I mean, films cost under $100,000. I didn't have a lot of money to put in. And they led to the third one of the trilogy, which was Berkeley, which was about my time in college. And it was really my attempt to link the generations between my generation and my son's and the two anti-war movements. And and on top of that, my son played the lead, which was based on me. And that was going to work every day, kind of trying to make art from my own story with my kid and other great people. Henry Winkler played my dad and... Bonnie Bedelia played the professor that, you know, that impacted on me. And then I became friends with Tom Morello, who was the guitar player for Rage Against the Machine, and the leader of his own band now. And Tom both acted in the movie and wrote original music. And I found one of my childhood heroes, Country Joe McDonald, Country Joe and the Fish, and he gave me music, worked on it. And it was just those movies had been by far the great pleasures. And also because we had nothing but, you know, people working hard for nothing, they were great pleasures in just seeing, you know, kind of deconstructing the business. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in a world where I can spend, you know, $100,000 or $200,000 in a day shooting a television show, to make a whole movie for, you know, half that was really a challenge and a fun one.
Yeah. You probably can. You still do that? You think what would $100,000 get you today?
Well, it wouldn't get you. I didn't get anything then. I mean, movies are easier and easier to make. The problem is there is nowhere to show them, and you know, unless you want to give it away and, you know, put it for free on the internet, which is kind of what I'm doing now. But there is no viable market for those movies. In fact, each one of those, and they were made between 98 and 2005 or 2006, it became more and more difficult to show them, even as they were getting easier and easier to make. And that's a big problem, which I imagine is going to get solved in our lifetime, but I don't know how.
Yeah. Well, we have like just a few seconds left to speak to you, but I just wanted to thank you for being with me today. This meant a lot. You know, you know how much it means.
I hope it worked. I hope we came up with something that people could.
Yeah, that was great. Yeah, it's. I'm sure everybody enjoyed listening to you, and thank you for taking an hour you know, out of your writing time? Because I know you're writing.
It was fun. I'll do anything to get out of writing. Okay, thanks,
Elizabeth.
Bye.
All right, take care. All right, bye-bye.